I'm Monica Johnson with Marshall Weber, and this is Brooklyn Calling. Hello, welcome to our show. It's been a few minutes, but we're back. Brooklyn Calling. It's where we talk about artists, libraries, and social justice. We're Brooklyn, Inc., an arts nonprofit located in Brooklyn, New York, on the unceded land of the Munsee Lenape people. We created Brooklyn Calling to amplify voices in the artist book field and to explore art making as a tool for community engagement and for social change. And while we are going to talk about that today, we are also going to focus very largely on the history of Brooklyn, which either has just not been told to the public or contested by many individuals. But today we wanted to bring on one of our founders to get to the bottom of some of the stories, Christopher C.K. Wilde. Why don't you say hi to the people, and then I'll read your bio so they know who you are. Hey, Christopher.
Oh, hello, comrades.
Hello, comrade Christopher.
Comrade.
Hello.
How's it going? Where are you today?
Doing great in Madison, Wisconsin. Beautiful day out. Some soup on the stove and my favorite hound in the world at my feet and talking to two friends. So I couldn't be better. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing good. Great.
We're all good. Now we're going to hear about Christopher Wilde. He is a Wisconsin-based artist working primarily in collage and book art. His work is held in over 70 collections worldwide, including the Getty, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, MoMA NYC in San Francisco, the New York Public Library, and the Biblioteca Alexandrina in Egypt. So that's what we can know. And also there's so much more to know, but we're going to put the full bio in the show notes. So head over there if you want to know more about this guy, if we don't cover it in the interview. So anyway, I thought, Marshall, let's start by just kind of going over why did we want to talk to Christopher today?
Well, that's kind of easy. Christopher's the first person to have the concept of what was to become Brooklyn, which is kind of a free-ranging, non-affiliated collective of artists distributing their own work and helping each other edition prints, collages, artist books. And there's a lot of stuff to throw around. So Christopher has a press called Artichoke Yink Press. He's part of the organic art group with me and Kurt Allerslev. He started the Collagistas, which is a collage collective in Madison, Wisconsin, that kind of led into Brooklyn. There was the Bookmobile, which also led into Brooklyn. So and then there was just kind of a social circle of artists and curators revolving around the son of Christopher. And a lot of it was just the charisma and the exuberance and the enthusiasm of looking at kind of an art world that celebrated individualism and this weird concept of studio isolation being superseded by, an art world that would look at cooperative and collective practice and social practice and look at the, raise the social group over the isolation of the individual. And Christopher was really the major force, the intellectual force. For many years, his home was both the site of the Bookmobile and Artichoke Yink Press, and then Brooklyn. A lot of generosity, physical generosity, intellectual generosity. As an educator, he has hundreds of loyal students, dozens of whom participated in all these projects that I've mentioned. So he kind of knows the details of this history in a way that no one else does. So I think it's great that we have a chance to kind of get granular with C.K. Wilde.
So I have similar motives in talking to you today, Christopher. My understanding is that Brooklyn started in 1999, but there are other versions that say 1998. So that's going to be something we're going to figure out today. So that's, you know, okay, say 26 years of nonprofit history that hasn't been written, has not been agreed upon. To my understanding and my observations, it's highly contested because everybody I talk to from the early days is like, this is how the word Booklyn came up. And they're like, no, that's totally not. It was like another person. It was like, it was Stacy. No, it was Christopher. No, Kurt came up with it. No, it happened when we were in the car. No, it happened when we were like renovating the squat. It was like, there's just so many versions of how Booklyn came to be. I want to talk to you because then you will be recorded. There is accountability here. And we know who said what.
Kurt was helping me move into 70 Commercial, which would eventually become Booklyn, at the end of 1997. We were driving across the bridge. It was very late at night. We had to move all of the stuff in the middle of the night, basically, to get everything over there. And as we were driving over the final time, I looked up and saw the sign saying, you know, welcome to Brooklyn. But I misread it and thought it said Booklyn. And at the time, Kurt and I were in discussions with Marshall and Stacy Wakefield to open a small bookstore on Bedford Street in Brooklyn. And I turned to Kurt and I said, ha, somebody mislabeled the sign and it says Booklyn. And then Kurt laughed. And then one of us said, that would be a good name for the bookstore. And neither one of us can remember which one said that. In any case, that's where the name came from. And it took a while because before that we were operating under the aegis and for at least another year or two of the Bookmobile, which was something that was kind of a nascent form of the distribution network that that Marshall helped set up thereafter. That's just one of the, you know, origin stories that people have for the name, at least. And then the third one on the list here is Bookmobile. So flashback to 1994, and I was still at school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, studying art and philosophy, and one of my mentors there was Bill Bunce, who was the head of special collections and rare books at the Kohler Art Library. I was going to see Bill, and I had made some new books that summer while living in New York, and I brought them to him and he said, well, these are great. They should be in the collection. And I hadn't even really thought about, you know, selling them. It was really just about making them. And so I said, well, yes, please. And so he bought them for a princely sum at the time, which kind of blew my mind. You know, it was like 2 months worth of rent from these two books. I couldn't believe it, you know, and it sparked this idea that, like, oh, you know, I could actually make a living as an artist selling my books directly to libraries. And I grew up in Wisconsin, which is in Madison, which is a university town. And the Bookmobile would come by twice a week to my neighborhood. And I was, you know, it was like ice cream truck, but for books. And I absolutely loved it. And, you know, would storm out there, and I had a library card for, you know, as long as I can remember. I've always had a library card. So I would go out there and I would choose some new books and check them out. And then when the Bookmobile would come through again, I would, you know, return those books and get some new books. So the idea of like a mobile, you know, book repository was already, you know, long in my sort of, you know, ledger domain. And, so the idea then became like, well, what about all of these other artists that I know that are making books that have no place to show them? And, you know, in Madison, Bill would gladly, you know, take appointments to look at people's work and give them commentary and then show them other books that they might want to look at. You know, he was incredible. When I eventually moved to New York in 95, I asked him if there were people who I should go to see with my books. And he very generously gave me a list of private collectors, dealers, and curators and librarians, which was then expanded upon by Walter Hamady, who was one of the teachers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who was teaching book arts, papermaking, binding, printing. And that became the initial basis for the Bookmobile distribution network. So, you know, the first appointment that I made was with Tony Zwicker, who was one of the only artist book dealers in the world at that time. And she had a amazing penthouse suite at the National Arts Association on Gramercy Park. And she very graciously met with me and looked at my work and agreed to represent me. And several months went by, and I, you know, would very timidly ask her if anybody had seen my work or purchased any work. Tony would always say to me, like, yeah, some people saw the work, you know, but they also saw the work of, you know, 20 other artists that day. And, you know, so I was like, well, how can I get this work seen by more people? And she said, well, why don't you go and see this person or that person? And some of those people were some of the same people that Bill had put on his list. So the first person that I went to go see in New York was Bobby Rainwater at the New York Public Library's Rare Books. When I went, I said, well, you know, as long as I'm going, I might as well take the work of some of these other artists whose work I admire. So after that meeting, he had purchased, I think, four different books or maybe five different books. And that was the first sale officially for the Bookmobile. None of the structure had been figured out at that point in terms of how to do it. But, you know, he had bought the books and I gave him an invoice handwritten on the back of a piece of typing paper. And I think I sold one of Marshall's books, one of my books, one of Kurt's books, and one of Karen Heft's books. And I came out on the steps on 42nd Street and felt absolutely elated. And the possibility for, you know, somehow making a living as a person who makes these esoteric objects, i.e. artist books, seemed possible at that moment. And it began a discussion with Marshall about how this might be actually possible as a business, as something that we could do, you know, on a larger scale.
Going back to like the motivation that when you went to Bill Bunce and you asked like, you know, what should I do basically? Or like, or he said to you, like, you should, you know, meet with this librarian or that librarian. Leading up to that moment, the folklore that I've been working with is that you, or the way I had understood it was like, it was all of y'all were like making books and sort of trying to appeal to what some degree of the commercial market with little success. And so it was almost like out of a necessity or maybe even a frustration that you turned to Bill Bunce, or, you know, however that stumbled into being, that it sort of came together out of not being able to find what seemed like the direction for an artist, a young artist in New York City with artwork to show. Is that accurate?
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, at the time, you know, do-it-yourself DIY stuff was, you know, pretty ripe in the culture, and I was particularly interested in zine culture, but also how it might intersect with book arts culture, which at the time were still fairly separated. And so Marshall, coming from San Francisco, was well familiar with the zine scene there. And he gave me some writing, which I then put into this the zine that I was publishing at the time. And Kurt was already making...
Do you remember the zine's the title?
Yeah, it was this one called Tragic Book Number 5, which is a whole other weird sort of project, which we can go into or not.
Oh, yeah. Let's go. But,
and in some ways, it was... completely disinterested in in market capitalism, because it was it was a lost leader from the beginning. There was no money to be made in the project. And in fact, it was designed that way. The only people who would get a copy of the book were the people who participated in the making of the book. There was always one extra copy so that there would be a complete set of the books at the end of the project. But it had nothing to do with anybody getting paid or recognition or famous or anything like that. It was really just the joy of making this publication for ourselves. And so that was the project that I asked Marshall to participate in, and gladly he did. And when he got the book, he was like, these are great. I really like these books. Let's make more. And he had already made this incredible project happen where he was cutting up all of the clothing catalogs that came to his house unbidden and reconfigured them with collage and deturned all of the images to make it a catalog about consumerism, about catalog culture, and you know, other esoteric concerns that Marshall could probably talk a little bit more eloquently about than I can. But I was totally thrilled by it, because also at that time there was this whole sort of determinant of advertising culture, I guess is maybe what you would call it, and that this was the most crystalline example I'd ever seen. And it was, you know, produced in such a way that made it look like the very catalogs that it was, you know, critiquing. And so I asked him if I could publish a larger edition of it, and he said yes. And so that those two projects were kind of the beginning of some of the collaborations that Marshall and I have continued to do now for over 30 years in the book form.
But were you trying to sell your books too? I'm just curious, like, even if it wasn't like commercial gallery spaces as like the end game for commerce or distribution, were you like trying to sell them in another way outside of the library system?
No, not really. I mean, the first books I sold were those ones to Bill Bunce. And then when I moved to New York, I thought I was going to be, you know, represented by this high powered, you know, artist book dealer. But it was really the frustration that, you know, I had made all of these books and continued to make all these books, and none of them were getting, you know, nobody had access to them, even in the auspices of a dealer. So there was a frustration there, but mainly just, you know, there was an impatience and enthusiasm. You know, Marshall kept on making books. Kurt kept on making books. Mark kept on making books. Sarah kept on making books. And yet there was no place for these books to get seen or interacted with.
I just wanted to say that along with this history, all this other stuff is happening too. Like Christopher mentioned that Bill Bunce was one of the co-founders of the Art Library Society of North America. And these associations and this kind of radicalization of a lot of the academic library world, and this is the kind of professional environment that would support Booklyn and other more politically progressive organizations, because all these kind of formal and distribution concerns are powered by kind of ideological beliefs, whether it's socialism, human rights, civil rights, property rights, as in with the squatting movements, you know, kind of diversity issues. So the Art Library, you know, the Art Library Society of North America, what we colloquially know as ARLIS, that's really the first library association that is founded on really progressive values. I mean, they're not bibliophiles, they're educators. And so the kind of progressive, you know, construction of the popular library and the progressive librarian, that starts with all those people. And so, you know, they already, you know, have things going on when Booklyn comes along. So Bill Bunce isn't just, I mean, he was an exceptional individual, but he was also part of a larger professional movement that had to do with diversifying and making the library system more progressive across academia and into the public libraries. So Booklyn, I think a lot of what Booklyn was able to do and able to form is because all this other stuff is going on in the arts and in the library cultures and in academia. And Bookland kind of like rode along with that. There's like these parallel histories.
I think that's a good way to think about it. Yeah.
That are very intertwined in actuality. Because there were the we take for granted this network of hundreds of libraries now, but it probably wouldn't have been possible without all those professional and social changes that happened then in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. That's what I mean. He was planting the seeds for all of this stuff, you know, since like 1973 or something, 74.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
Because I'm sort of like the proverbial listener, right, who didn't live the history. And so it was like, what are you talking about? So, okay, a few things. So I do want to keep on track to be, I know that the bookmobile does transition or evolve into Bookland at some point. So we don't have to answer that right now. But I want to understand more about like what the bookmobile was. I think you were on that path and then, you know, I interrupted. But you're describing like, you were in, I don't know, a car or something, and you traveled across the country, and that was the bookmobile? Or like, was there something visually identifying as the bookmobile? Or just can you paint us a picture of what that entire thing, maybe like, you talked about how it started, but how did it really like, what was at the height of the bookmobile? How did it function? And then maybe why did it stop? Which might be why, how it transitioned to Bookland.
So Sean Schooler and I, picked up a 1971 Ford Torino, green Ford Torino, and a teardrop camper, and attached it to the bumper of that, and started out in Corvallis, Oregon, and made our way down the coast and then across the country visiting libraries. And the end goal was to then move Sean and I into 70 Commercial, which eventually became Bookland's first home. And so, yeah, we had this like, you know, teeny little flag on our teardrop camper, and you know, we'd pull up at these libraries and like come unfurling ourselves from this giant 70s Torino, and we stopped at, you know, at places that had absolutely no idea what to make of us. You know, like we went to the Getty and like wheeled in these suitcases full of artist books from mostly creators that they never heard of, and representing.
But they agreed to meet with you. That feels significant. That's incredible. Why did they agree to meet with you?
Having Bill Bunce's name and Judith Hoffberg's name to mention was a very strong entree, because these were two of the most highly respected intellectuals in the field, and they had given their personal blessing to, you know, this harebrained scheme. And, you know,
I feel like that's a great message for the future, is that if you are in a position to give your blessing to a harebrained scheme by a couple of 20-year-olds, just do it.
Do it.
Okay, that's the bookmobile. It ended up in Greenpoint. And then and then it became Bookland. And that happened, you know, you were going to have a bookstore. You thought of the name of the bookstore when you misread the sign on the way to moving to Greenpoint. And the bookstore never happened? Just sort of fell through?
Bookstore never happened. The storefront on Bedford was a magazine stand. And it was too small to accommodate the teaching platform that I had wanted to engage with. And eventually the bookstore distribution was taken over by another person that was involved with Bookland, Amanda Taylor. She had a bookstore already in place that was showing zines called Clovis Books. Mm-hmm. And that was on Bedford, just a little bit further down the way. And so I taught some bookbinding classes there. And basically the inception of Bookland was that finally we had a location in Greenpoint where all of the social aspect of making these books could be engaged with. So we started having salons every Tuesday night that anybody could come to who was interested in the book arts, you know, either printing or papermaking or binding, whatever. And so, you know, that started this, you know, to formalize what was already a happening social scene. and to sort of open it up to a larger public. And the distribution stuff started to take on more and more import. Marshall and I, everybody at the time, but eventually it was just Marshall and I for a long time, were distributing these works to collections all over the Eastern Seaboard. And it got to the point where there was actual money transferring hands. And so we had to figure out a more formal structure for it. And luckily, you know, Kurt and Marshall and Peter Spanuolo had experience in setting up not-for-profits. And so, yeah. And then in 99, we had a very strong community of people that were more than willing to step up and become the sort of first board members and formalize the structure of Bookland. And in so doing, articulate what it is that we wanted this organization to do. And, it was, based on education, it was based on art and expression. And from that, the next 26 years have sprouted and grown into this incredible organization that's helped out hundreds and hundreds of artists and maybe thousands of artists and institutions.
The initial corporate structure was what do they call that? An LLC.
Yeah, limited liability corporation.
And it was supposed to be the three of us, but Christopher was late for the signing. So me and Kurt were the signatories of the first Bookland Artists Alliance, kind of officially. And as with Artist Television Access, which actually morphed out of Martin Weber Gallery, these commercial projects were formed to just kind of start the seed of the corporation, and then were switched over into not-for-profits. In Bookland's case, the New York Foundation for the Arts has this amazing program where they foster, that you share their not-for-profit status. They become your fiscal receiver, but the program fosters the creation of new not-for-profits. And so we got into that NYFA program, and they quickly, within the space of a year, we were already putting in our not-for-profit status, applications to the federal government and the state of New York. NYFA was so closely related or was working closely with the New York State Arts Council. That was a shoo-in. It was easy for us to get our state not-for-profit status. A somewhat more bewildered IRS agent actually rewrote our application for us, and then we got our federal.
Why did they have to rewrite it?
I think it was just like they didn't rewrite it because it was not a good application. They rewrote it because nobody knew what artist books were.
Got it.
And no one understood what we were doing, which is a typical Bookland problem. No one.
It continues.
Many people still don't really understand, which is one reason why we're doing.
So it's a coffee table book. It's like a big book that sits on your coffee table about someone's art career.
That's why we're doing this podcast. But I also
think that this happened in a time. This is also for any fact checkers out in the world to tell us what really happened. But historically, I think this was a time when there was some shift in policy that encouraged more creation of small nonprofits. And there was a program that may not exist, at least not in the same form, that where NYFA, did that fiscal sponsorship. But it was like there, I feel like there were like a dime a dozen nonprofits sprouting up between like, I don't know if it was like 99 and 2003 or something like that. But we kind of, weaseled in is not the right way to say it, but like we got in this door that opened up for a lot of other folks. And so we got lucky.
Well, and that was a cycle that happened, from, you can take it all the way back to the a WPA. You have a progressive administration. They encourage educational projects. Then the conservatives come in and they shut that shit down. And then the 60s happen and they encourage it again. And then conservatives come in and they shut it down. And then it happens again. And during the 80s, there's a real bloom. And then Reagan shuts that down. And then Clinton kind of opens it up again. So yeah, we were
But then there was Piss Christ. And then like the NEA got a bunch of grief from a lot of lobbyists. And exactly. Maybe this condition was in response to that to a certain extent.
So I want to say that we also need to give props to our current Brooklyn president of the board, Kurt Allerslev. Kurt did a lot of the legal work and a lot of the actual, the filling out of forms and the discussing of legislation and rules and corporate structure and all that. You know, our early grants, we were just getting them left and right because no one else was doing what we were doing. I mean, it was a very interesting situation.
It should be said also that many of these librarians and curators only would see each other maybe once a year at some sort of conference, at some kind of academic conference or something like that. Nobody was going to see these librarians and curators with their books. There was some sort of invisible barrier that many creators didn't feel like they could engage these institutions with their work. And so they were overjoyed to have a, you know, person come in with 30 new books for them to look at, you know, literally hot off the presses, from creators as diverse as possibly could be found. And we're just incredibly excited to see this stuff. Many of these institutions are not able to justify their budgets unless they buy things. And so, you know, all of a sudden here was, you know, this very shiny Marshall Weber at their doorstep with some books in a briefcase or a suitcase.
Which is still the case.
Yep.
And week, in fact.
He could lucidly describe the artist and their process and their motivations and the processes at work in the books, and also explain their connection to various, you know, other art history movements, etc. And then they could engage their students with the work. So, you know, frequently when we would go to see these librarians, they would have their library science students there, who were fascinated in, you know, all the different manifestations of the book as they could possibly get their hands on. And they would all be thrilled and be able to ask questions of us. And we, as artists who were actually participating in the medium, could answer in a different way than a salesman could. You know, we knew these artists. We knew the processes that they were working with because we were working with those same processes and people.
I want to paint a little picture for people who don't understand library culture or why Brooklyn would even be possible with all the stuff that we've been talking about. It's kind of like, well, why? How could that? It still doesn't sound legit. So if you roll back about 30 years, the whole kind of special collections world is pretty much controlled by like dudes, like literally with those patches on their jackets and stuff. And remember that before the internet, there's no way to access or evaluate usage or catalogs without actually going to the freaking library and going through their card catalog or calling them up. So the traditional conventional book dealers who were part of a cabal called ABAA, you couldn't even become a book dealer. You couldn't get into this club unless you had like three references from other people in the club. Like, so this was like a strictly colonial bibliophilic model for distribution, mostly all white men selling books by all white men, mostly really focused on Europe and Britain or American presses that imitated that stuff. And there were librarians who wouldn't even see you if you weren't a member of this, you know, cabal, which of course the cabal would kind of paint everyone who wasn't a member as potential fraudulent criminals and only they were legit. And then if you were an artist and you had one of these old school dealers, even let's say you were working with Tony Zwicker, you wouldn't necessarily know when your book was sold. There was a practice called standing order. where your librarian dude friend would like agree to buy every book that your dude press produced forever. It was like, wow. So when the internet came, all of a sudden everybody's collections were public and you could see that these collections were, one, not being used, two, were almost all completely the same because they're all buying from all the same dealers or they all have standing orders with all the same presses, no diversity, politically conservative, really, you know, Euro-focused. And so the 90s kind of blows up this whole secret story.
So there was like data accountability for the first time that people could access.
And it changes everything. And one of the first things Bookland did was do all this research to see where all our artists' books were from all these different commercial dealers and found out that a lot of artists hadn't gotten paid for books all over the country.
Oh, my goodness.
And so while we made a lot of enemies in the kind of, you know, boring bibliophilic world, artists were like really happy. They were like happy in the sense that, oh my gosh, my work is in the Getty. My work is at UCLA. My work is in the New York Public Library. I didn't know that. I'm going to put that on my resume. And then, you know, wait a few minutes. And then the artist then goes, hey, I didn't get paid for that.
Well, this feels like a good time to just mention that for anybody out there who has work that you suspect has been collected within the library system, go to worldcat.org and put your name in, put all sorts of ways of spelling your name because, you know, mistakes happen. But I find that one of the most like redeeming things to be distributing my own work within the education and library system, because you can actually find where your work is. It's not like in the basement of some collector or some friend or just whoever bought your work. And that's, you know, that's fine. You got paid. There was a transaction. But to also be like, I get to know that my work is held by these institutions. And then you can copy and paste that right into your CV if you need to. So worldcat.org. But just going back to like where the bookmobile started and you started, you know, you convinced the Getty to see you. Once you understand the history that Christopher is describing of like what were the progressive pebbles that led to that system becoming a system and expanding and then retracting and expanding. And we're still a small nonprofit, but we pack the trunk, we bring our friends' books, we bring books from people who might be our friends someday, but just artists that we've come to know in various channels. And we sell on behalf of people. But after that, there's no contract, there's no protection, there's no ownership, there's no mediation. We don't have the interest or the infrastructure to have exclusive contracts with artists. And to be honest, like, yeah, it's like, we love influencing the possibility of work that we value, that we see an immense amount of importance in having in research and educational institutions, advocating for them and getting it into the institution. It's not at all about like having a cut of an artist's career, because once that artist is in the institution, like there is no way that the artist shouldn't feel like they have access to communicating, doing their own sales if they want to. When it comes down to it, like I'm an artist who doesn't want to work any more than I have to. And so advocating for your own work in an institution is fine, but it's a whole mess of work to try to collect money. It's worked to like figure out how to like ship it there. It's just work. And it's work that we're happy to do because we're motivated to do it, but we don't mediate artist relationships with institutions. And we try to remind the artists that that's not what our goal is or what we're here to do. But yeah, I just love that we can do that.
One of the initial ideas that we played around with was that everybody that was participating with Bookland would represent each other's works. So we wouldn't have to send Marshall to California. We would have an artist in California that we would send the books to, and they would go to the institutions there. That, however, in practice, turned out to be exactly what you were talking about. I would much rather be making art than going and selling art. And that's how many of the artists felt. And so they were happy for there to be an institutional framework that would represent them and their work and deal with the payment structure and following up on things and making sure that they got paid. And, you know, that sort of initial egalitarian notion that everybody would represent everyone else in practice turned out to be untenable because many people had other jobs, you know, teaching or whatever. And so they couldn't represent the other artists, even if they wanted to. And there was, at least at the time, the initial idea was that, you know, we would be a true collective and that everybody would shoulder the burden together. But it turned out in practice that certain people were better at certain things. It became, you know, reflexive to the needs of the people who are actually doing the work. For instance, you know, my rather evangelical approach to teaching people how to bind books, you know, I've taught bookbinding all over the world, in Bhutan, in China, in Russia. It's something that I feel very strongly about. And it's something that other people like Sarah Parkell were like, oh, yeah, let's make sure that there's an educational component to this that isn't just showing the work, but showing people how to make the work itself. So there was periods of time where people had access to a letterpress in Bookland Studio in Greenpoint, and they could learn how to set type. They could learn how to use, an old-fashioned platen press. They could learn, you know, five or six different binding styles from all over the world. And then take that to their classrooms. It was teaching kids, it was teaching art students, it was teaching, you know, librarians, everybody who was interested could gain access to this knowledge and didn't have to go through an educational institution like, you know, a college or a university to get it. But yeah, so there was always a component to it that was educational, but not just showing people what people had done, but how to do it themselves. So zinesters could get engaged as well as, you know, fine press people.
Wasn't that also part of the Tuesday salon nights? There was kind of like a labor Skillshare structure that you had for a while?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those first two bookmobile catalogs were all assembled by hand by the Bookland crew. You know, it was a lot of paper folding and a lot of printing and a lot of binding that needed to happen to get those out into the world. But similarly, any such project would just be taken on by the staff. So all the design was in-house, all the printing was in-house, all the distribution via mail or by hand was all done by people, you know, within the organization. It was just something that happened very organically.
Right. And that really was part of supporting that culture of the, the collective cooperative press, you know, the socialist model for publishing, where people are publishing collectively, both in terms of, you know, intellectual design of the literature or the artwork, but also making it together in the shop.
There's one, Marshall, before you were talking about like a lot of the things that were happening and changing in the library culture, in library systems in the 90s and early aughts, and how Bookland sort of, you know, benefited from or like grew alongside and within those changes. There's another like cultural space that I'm really curious about hearing, you know, both of you talk about that were definitely part of the foundations of how Bookland came to exist. One is squatting culture, and the other one is punk culture. And yep. So I don't know, it's not one thing, but I just want to hear what you guys have to say about, like, you know, how you see a lot of those cultural origins of where you lived and how you were socially as people, and how you can now look back and see, maybe you can see that in Bookland now, maybe you can just identify some decisions that you explicitly made in the foundation of Bookland.
For me, I was always in the margins and found myself in the company of a lot of anarchists and punks of various stripes and squatters, was an act of necessity as well as political defiance at the time. And so Kurt was involved with the squats, and I should say that his legal teeth got cut on squatters' rights advocacy within the court system in New York City. But through that community, he introduced Marshall and I to Stacy Wakefield, whose Evil Twin Press published Not for Rent, which is considered to be, I think now, without a doubt, one of the sort of seminal pieces of publishing having to do with the squatting scene in Europe as well as in New York. You know, Stacy was one of the people who, understood what we were trying to do with these books in a different way, because she came from the Dutch traditions of self-publishing and was very supportive of our efforts in terms of trying to teach people how to bind books within the zine community, which I definitely associate with punk and DIY. I was sort of, inured to that political scene just because of my affiliations and how I'm sort of built. And, and Marshall obviously had, 10, 15 years of experience within the punk scene when I even met him. So there was already, a lot of exposure to these ideas that he had already amassed at that point when I met him. And so it felt like he understood where we were coming from with the zines that we were making at the time already, and that there was a cultural framework around it that he could inform us of beyond, our own sort of small lens or cell of, anarcho hippies or whatever you want to call them.
Right. I want to underline that it wasn't just me, because there were all these presidential relationships between punk and anarchist organizations well before Brooklyn even happens. And a lot of it is this Lower East Side progressive, underground artist scene. So when I was working at curating for Artist Television Access, at one of the big arts conferences, I met Lou Asierno. And this is 1988 or something like that. I met Lou Asierno and Fly at the mm-hmm. National Association of Art Organizations. And so there was already kind of a San Francisco, New York punk connection in my mind. I mean, my whole family are progressive Jew Yorkers anyways. So I had all these connections to New York.
Can you say who Lou Asierno is?
Lou Arciano was working for ABC No Rio.
Okay.
So, so that meeting kind of ends up with, in 1989, Artist Television Access does the first retrospective of World War III Illustrated in San Francisco.
Right on.
We bring all these punk anarchists and, radical anti-war, anti-racist folks, and we do this amazing show that fills... Everywhere is in the, not just the gallery, but the entire place is filled with this art. And that really cements this relationship between San Francisco and Artist Television Access and the Lower East Side. And then kind of getting back to New York is a little bit like coming home, because Brooklyn always represented Fly, and I knew Fly before Brooklyn. And so there was all this kind of agreed political culture already kind of in place, all these relationships between many of the people. World War III Illustrated, basically almost every radical cartoonist, comic maker, illustrator, graphic designer, sooner or later did or does something with them. So that's an amazing social, political, and professional resource for Brooklyn. Just knowing Eric Drucker and Seth DeBachman and Sabrina Jones and folks like that, Mac McGill, a lot of those people would go on to like publish or be distributed by Brooklyn. So it's like we were returning all these favors from all these people who at the beginning were really helping us out.
I just love our history so dearly. And going back to the reason that I want to do this and Marshall wants to do this and, Marshall, you've been here since the beginning. I can't believe you're still here. But I am so grateful that you are.
I am. Yes.
It is great. And, Marshall, you and I talk about this all the time. Like, there is a real interesting, rich, very profound negotiation when you have this deep organizational history and knowledge. And in a lot of ways, Brooklyn just kind of I don't mean to say like stumbled into being, but not like you weren't making deliberate choices, but it wasn't like someone had a grand design. You know, you were young folks. You just kind of like you built it as you went along. And so after this many years, of course, we can look back and be like, oh, well, we didn't do that very well. Or, you know, you can look at any like record keeping or like, I mean, for sure, like, I, you know, we all know, like I came in and I looked at what was going on. I was like, I don't understand any of this. But it's like, it is something to be cherished. It's something to be cared for. It's something to know that, like, you know, I have the immense privilege of being able to, you know, work at Booklyn every day, which doesn't, I don't mean that in as like boring of a way as it sounds. I'm just so grateful that whatever happened to make Booklyn exist now, that it exists so that I can be part of it.
A lot of why Booklyn is here is really because of librarians and activists and people in the neighborhood and in the in academia, especially in academic art libraries and special collections libraries, who are absolutely superheroes and heroines who have supported us, sometimes vocally, sometimes covertly. But it's just kind of, to me, that is one of the most amazing facts about Booklyn is we've sort of run on the goodwill of people who are much more knowledgeable about what we're doing than we are.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, they validate what we only suspect is true.
Right. So, I mean, I could go, I would be here all day, but I would definitely want to say, like, you know, shout outs to Bill Bunce and shout outs to Susie Taraba and shout outs to Mark Dimionation and shout outs to Roberto Trujillo and Christina Favretta and shout outs to Sada Mitchell. And I mean, there's literally hundreds of names of librarians who not only made this happen, but they are continuing to make Booklyn.
I feel like we should have a page on our website, that a thank you page, that would just go on forever and ever, because there's so many people that I could even name, least of all you guys.
And the culture of both modesty and political expedience would have them all saying, oh no, don't do that.
Well, and I want to say one final thing as well, which is that which echoes what you're saying, Marshall, that The reason why Booklyn continues to exist is that the book as a medium is unparalleled in its intimate communication, and that there is really nothing else in the world like a book that is cradled by the reader, created by the artists in a collective way, because it takes a village to make any book happen. You know, there's, especially if you want to do it well, there are people who are really good at all the various aspects of the making of a book. But there are also people on the other side of it who are good at taking care of it and making sure that it gets used as an object of expression and education, and that it's a medium that's open to anyone. And that egalitarian quality, that anyone knows how to pick up a book and read it, and anybody can make it, is kind of like that if you can talk, you can sing, if you can walk, you can dance thing. And, you know, there is no other medium like the book. People were worried that with the digital revolution, the book was going to disappear. And in fact, it's only made the artist book stronger and more vibrant and more diverse. And that's all made because of people's love of communication and expression, and the librarians and the institutions that have supported Booklyn's mission, and the artists and the printers and the binders. All of those people have made it possible for this organization to survive these last 26 years. I'm incredibly grateful to have been a small part of making that happen. And I'm so incredibly proud to know both of you and to see you make the organization be what it is today in so many ways. So I'm very grateful to both of you. Thank you so much for all of your efforts.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Booklyn Calling. Check out the show notes for more details and for ways to see more of Christopher Wilde's work online. And if you're a librarian or a curator and you're working at an educational institution, and if you're interested in collecting Christopher's work or others like it, you can email us at hello@bookland.org or check out our entire collection at bookland.org. And as always, it is Bookland, like Brooklyn, but no R. See you next time. This podcast was made possible in part by funds from the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs and in partnership with the City Council, and from individual donors to Bookland, Inc. You can support this podcast by making a donation at bookland.org/donate.